Okay, so we're going to talk a little bit today about magnetic fields in channeling mass loss, and this occurs in the massive stars because there's a subset of massive stars that are strongly magnetic with high order magnetic fields, but it's also historically important in cool stars, which have rotation convection dynamos and generate magnetic fields, and it's thought to that's playing a dominant role in driving the solar wind. Solar wind only loses 10 to the minus 14 solar masses per year, so from the point of view of stellar evolution, it's totally unimportant. But because it has the magnetic field, can extend, effectively extend the amount of angular momentum that's being lost, the sun has spun down, and Jennifer's going to tell us all about spin down in cool stars. But what I thought I'd do, or what I was asked to do basically, was to give a little general introduction to magnetic wind magnetic spin down. And I'm going to do it, I'm going to try to do it on the blackboard. I hope I don't screw up too much. So that provides a kind of a broad overview for what occurs in. So basically, this is just like we had the lecture yesterday. We start with a sphere with little wiggles coming out of it.
and that's when we all stop listening.
So basically, this is supposed to be a star. We're looking down on the equatorial plane. And if the star is rotating, then the magnetic field lines that are coming off the star get bent in this spiral structure. And the bending of this magnetic field has associated torques that give rise from the Poynting stresses that give rise to angular momentum loss, along with the angular momentum loss of the gas itself. So this idea, really, I think the first really great analysis was, I think, 1967 by Weber and Davis. I might as well spell it out. And I'm going to basically review that and how it's been sort of modified for current day work. So Weber and Davis pointed out that the total amount of angular momentum loss per unit mass, this is angular momentum, specific angular momentum per unit mass, can be given by the phi component of the velocity. This is the angular momentum associated with the gas, plus the Poynting stresses, which are written in this form. I believe that's correct. Let me make sure. Rho, there's a rho VR here. That's important. Okay, so this is J magnetic field. And then the other thing that's required is that in the frame moving in what's called basically in the co-rotating frame, the gas, if it's ionized, the magnetic field and the gas have to fall along the same trajectories. So this is called the frozen flux condition. And that has the form of B phi over BR is equal to omega R minus B phi divided by VR. So this is so-called frozen flux. Now, what's interesting is if you combine these two equations, then you get a very nice relation, which is basically that the angular momentum of the gas, which is just, as again, V phi R, can be written as the total angular momentum times the Mach number squared, the Alphanic Mach number squared, minus omega r squared, divided by the Mach number squared minus 1, where the Mach number is just squared, is just defined to be Br squared over 8 pi rho, 8 pi rho Vr squared. So basically, no, it's 4 pi rho r squared. Anyway, this here is the Alphane speed, And so we're just basically Alphane, this is inverse of the Mach number, I'm sorry. This is the inverse. This is the Alphane speed over the radial flow speed. So if you look at this equation for a second, then you realize that when you go through the Alphane critical point, that is where the flow speed equals the Alphane speed, that this term will vanish, and the whole thing will blow up unless the numerator also vanishes. So if the numerator vanishes, then what it implies, that the numerator is on zero, implies that J is equal to omega R Alphane squared. So the total amount of angular momentum that's being lost is as if the gas were to co-rotate out to the Alphane radius. This provides kind of like the moment arm of the angular momentum loss. Okay, so now it's important to emphasize here that it doesn't mean that literally the gas co-rotates out to the Alphane radius and then is let go. What's really happening is that most of the angular momentum that's being lost is actually in the pointing stresses. In the Weber and Davis model, typically 70-80% is in the pointing stresses. And only 30% is in the direct V phi times R term. Okay? So that's the major result from it. And so if we have this result, then the total amount of angular momentum that's lost is now, you just have to multiply times the mass loss rate, omega R Alphane squared. And all this analysis was done in the equatorial plane. And in the Weber and Davis model, they just modify it by talking about spirals at higher and higher latitudes. And there's a correction factor of 2/3 for the integration over the whole sphere. So this is the classic Weber and Davis scaling result for how much angular momentum is being lost.
So that's if RA is evaluated in the equatorial plane.
That's RA and not yet defined, which we're going to now talk about. Okay, so what is the scaling of RA? It was a good plant there. I put Chris up to that last night while we were drinking scotch.
I can't remember.
I planted it so deep inside your subconscious that you don't even know.
Or so, he was drinking more than he thought he was.
That's right. Anyway, okay, so what is our Alphane? Well, it should be the place where the Mach number is equal to 1. So if we just go back to this Mach number Alphane squared, that's just V Alphane B squared over 4 pi rho V R, right? V R squared. Okay? So if you look at this, you can look at it a couple of different ways. This is the Alphane speed divided by the flow speed. But another way you can look at it is if you write it in this way, B squared over 8 pi times 1/2 rho VR squared. This is the way I prefer to look at it, okay? Because everybody knows this is the energy density of the magnetic field, and this is the kinetic energy density of the wind, right? So energy density, yeah, energy per unit volume.
That's if VR is the dominant field.
VR is the flow, radial flow that's carrying the flux, the mass flux.
This is B, you have that as BR squared, you turn it into B squared. Oh
yeah, well I,
but B squared,
that's close. Right,
so
but that's basically, the phi field just wraps up, but in terms of the definition of the Mach number here, well if you go through, the definition of the Mach number is BR squared over 4 pi rho.
Right, but what I'm saying is when you convert it to the energy density,
yeah, I should.
Then that means that you have, okay, so you're saying BR, because then it's not the energy density.
Right, there's a magnetic field, but it's the energy density, to put it this way, it's the pressure, the radial pressure. Maybe it's better to think about it as a pressure.
What goes through this surface?
I can say that, but it's not magnetic energy density because
it's not the total magnetic density. It's the radial component of the magnetic pressure.
Okay.
So maybe it's better to think about it in terms of pressure, and then this is the dynamic pressure of the stellar wind. Okay, but now Now that's now the point is that this, if we multiply times r squared on the top and the bottom, then rho vr, let's put the 4 pi back down. Well, let me go and leave it the way it was and continue on the next line. Let's rewrite this as Br squared times R squared times 4 pi rho Vr R squared Vr. Well, this is just the mass loss rate of the wind. Okay? And so now we have a relation that looks like this, Vr squared over m dot Vr. And now we have to ask ourselves, how do the numerator and denominator vary with radius? Well, typically stellar winds, by the time they get a little away from the surface, they're moving at their, so this is approximately m dot V infinity, because the wind gets going, and that, you know, if we're going to have a moment arm that's expressed outward, it's pretty close to terminal speed. And then this now.
Although the radius sometimes only like a true stellar radius on the.
I'm sorry?
Well, we're
arguing now about orders of like one or two. We're trying to get a big picture, right? And I can tell you from stellar winds, from radiation-driven winds, that it gets very quickly. But yeah, there are modifications to this picture. I'm trying to give you an overview of what happens. You could put in a velocity law in there if you wanted to, and it would
modify. I think that the Putin velocity law is what changes from one prescription to another prescription that people end up with a final form.
Well, we can talk about that maybe later or this afternoon when we have our further discussion. Okay, but for now, just let me do this. And now what we can do is we can say, let's write this as B equatorial on the surface of the star, R star squared times a ratio BR over B equatorial squared times R over R star squared.
So that's.
Now this quantity, I'm sorry?
So you have to say which. So this is the way of changing the field in what assumption?
I've made no assumptions. I've just redefined a surface value for this quantity, and then I've scaled it to the surface value. I've not made any more approximations.
No, I mean, this scaling, it assumes already geometric torsion. Just to make sure, but it's not
the Weber and Davis model.
That it goes.
This is the Weber and Davis model. Okay? We'll come back to the what happens when a dipole and stuff like that. All right? So this quantity here is a constant of the it's set by the strength of the magnetic field. Yeah?
No. I'm just saying that magnetic field doesn't always change that way.
And that's just a mathematical substitution.
That's just a mathematical substitution. There's no assumption yet. Okay? Look at it. It's all I've done is divided through by b squared r star squared and wrote in b equator r star.
But we know you're going to make this assumption.
I'm going to talk about that. Give me a moment to talk about what's going to happen with the scaling. Okay.
Tough ground.
Okay. This is what it's like. Okay. So I'm going to call this quantity eta star. It's kind of like a beta upside down, but it's for wind. See, if this in the denominator had been the gas pressure, this would have been 1 over beta. I always hated the fact that beta had B in the denominator, right? So now when I designed the quantity, I decided to call it eta, but put the B in the numerator, because the higher eta is, the more important the magnetic field is. And now we can have a discussion about this all afternoon about how to calculate this quantity, but I'm going to just basically do this, okay? I'm going to say that that in general, BR scales like R over minus N plus 1, where N is the order of the dipole.
Field.
Order of the field. the order of the field. If it's a dipole, then n, if it's a monopole, n is equal to 1. If it's a dipole, n equals to 2, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, now you'll notice that now I'm breaking my rule that we're just talking about a split monopole magnetic field. So what Weber and Davis basically did is said, let's assume that the field gets ripped open and that there's a current sheet at the equator, and then basically everything on the north side is at one polarity, and everything on the south side is another polarity. And then we go from there. But now what I'm going to do is make the generalization that we can write this relationship in terms of an order. We don't just have to put in n equal to 1. We can do this, okay? And then what that means is that this quantity here, which is basically, if we call the quantity here eta, then this is eta over eta star. And then bottom line is that the magnetic field will fall off like this eta over eta star will fall off like R over R star to the minus 2n plus 2. Okay? So so now if I put in n equal to 2, 2n.
That looks like 2n plus,
it's 2n, yeah, that's right, because the r squared cancels the extra 1. Okay, that's better, yeah, sorry about that. Good, thank you, Chris. So eta over eta star is r over r star to the minus 2n. And in particular, for a monopole, this would just be 1 over the square root of r. But for a dipole, for n equal to 2, eta would fall off like r to the minus 4 over r star. And since the Alphane radius is defined as when this number is equal to 1, then you can see that the Alphane radius over R star just goes like eta star to the minus 1/4. Okay? And so we'll talk about how magnetic fields from massive stars are primarily first order dipole in most cases. There are some exceptions. But the argument is that that you can basically in general rewrite this as eta star to the 1 over 2n. And okay, so now what is happening when we go from being a monopole to a dipole? Well, in reality, the field might look like a dipole, like this. Let's do it now in longitude. As I say, we're looking at the equator now is here, and we're looking at latitudes. Magnetic field might do something like this, but then when the wind gets going, you get this kind of helmet streamer structure, named after German World War I Army helmets. And eventually the field becomes broken out to radial. And so what people have done, Mestel and people like that, is they've tried to exclude, since this is the only open field that actually is going to give you, they try to exclude this region. They call it a dead zone. But what we find in our simulations is that if you just continue to use this formula with an n that increases, you actually get scaling that matches the MHD simulations. So we can talk about that when I give my talk. But now,
So dead zone, what does it do?
It just basically excludes some of the field.
No, but on this functionality.
So what people try to do is they take say that some of the large amount of the solid angle is not actually feeding flux, and they account for the dead zone that it's only the flux that extends out to infinity. Out beyond the alpha.
How does that affect that scaling? Is
what I'm trying to say is that people in the past have tried to cook up a modified Weber and Davis and exclude the dead zone. But what I'm saying is if you just ignore the dead zone just count it, that the extra decrease with the magnetic field, making it go like 1 over r to, that making this number be 1 over the 1/4 power, will actually account for the dead zone. The MHT simulations show that this scaling actually gives you a very good result. But I have to wait till I can show you my results to do that. Now, the final point. Yep, go ahead.
Sorry, the final point. That's answering my question.
The final point I want to get to is that.
I'm sorry, but the question was how is, and let's say, I understand that you're saying that the accounting for the dead zone doesn't matter. But
accounting
let's
for the
say
dead zone
we were
is one way.
Let me finish. Let's say we were pre the time we knew that. Uh-huh. What was that scaling when the dead zone when Messel et al. Tried to include that dead zone?
They included basically. The Weber and Davis scaling, but they took out some of the flux from the star. They made a hole where there was no magnetic flux. And then they used the reduced flux of only the flux that's in open magnetic topology to actually count to put into B.
So they didn't get a new scaling, is what you're saying.
They got a new scaling that accounted for the dead zone.
But then what was that? That's what I'm asking.
Well, I don't know that off the top of my head.
Okay.
So I followed them, but I did the integration. So I mean, if you do the angle integration, I don't know. That's why I asked you. I was interested in various form, but I mean, I just did numerical integration, but I did see that. Well, I mean, it decreases with J dot, but however, it also increases with J dot because you can see the dipole field. So I mean, it's all plays out, right? I mean, in standard magnetic breaking, you can see the monopole. And then in dead zone, you actually can see the
yeah.
dipole, but then you take out for some part.
Yeah. So they're taking stuff out and putting stuff in.
Yeah.
And how they balance. Right.
It would affect the mass loss rate, right? Because the matter on those.
Yeah.
Let's see. I'm trying. Let's see. How does this go? So now, basically, we have a scaling for how the alpha and radius scales with. Over r star, so we can just plug that. It's basically, if we do it in general, it's 1/2 n. So if we do the square of this, it's 1/n minus 1/n, and so now what we can do, we had an alpha and radius here. Now we just put the stellar radius times this magnetic confinement parameter. This is what I call the magnetic confinement parameter. Okay, so what does that mean? Well, now if you want to figure out what's the spin down time, you just take omega and divide it by omega, the angle momentum of the star, divided by J dot. And then you get a scaling law, but it depends on this parameter, magnetic field, and the mass loss rate, and the flow speed. Now, the nice thing about hot stars, massive stars, is the mass loss rate is driven by radiation forces. And the magnetic field is measured from spectral polarimetry. Okay? So it's and there's no reason these magnetic fields are thought to be frozen in to the star. And so the spin down is basically very simple. It's exponential because the same mass loss comes off the star as it spins down. But in cool stars, the mass loss rate and the magnetic field are both functions of the rotation. They depend on the magnetic rotational dynamo. And so it's a much more complicated result. If I plot the spin down of massive stars, it's simply exponential. But typically what you see in cool stars, this is some kind of power law, sometimes called the Skoumanich law, which falls off t time to the minus 2 power, the total. And now what we're finding is, because the magnetic field being generated depends on a dynamo, which depends in some complicated way on something called the Rossby number, which I'm sure Jen will tell us all about, that there's a feedback effect. And now what we're finding is that the spin down evolution of cool stars has this kind of intricate feedback. And now with the results that you've gotten from Kepler, right, you are now able to actually empirically put constraints on how cool stars spin down.
So before we go to stars,
right.
We probably should let me here to talk about the stars. Just the last question about the equation.
It's not the last.
but the question, not about application, okay, because then we should send the application later. So it means that for dipole, so for monopole field, you will have that the J dot goes with B square, right? And for dipole field, it will only go with B.
That's right. That's right.
So, okay, I think that's the most important thing.
Yep. But it's also, if you look at it, if you have, this is 1,
yeah.
then this parameter has a 1 over M dot in it. And then that's an M dot. So what you find, what you conclude for a pure monopole is that the spin down does not depend on the mass loss rate. That's pretty surprising. Why is that?
Cool.
Because the more mass loss you have, you're going to carry more angular momentum per unit mass. But the angular momentum per unit mass depends on the alpha radius, which depends on the inverse of the mass loss rate. So you don't go out, you increase the mass, you kind of gain by adding more mass per unit mass per, you know, per particle. I mean, angular momentum per particle, but the angular momentum per particle goes down because the Alpine radius comes in. So in the case of mass of Weber and Davis, pure monopole scaling is independent of mass. And that's one of the other important things, along with the B squared thing that you mentioned.
Until the Alpine radius is inside the star.
Well, that's then you have to modify what you're doing.
Sorry?
I mean, this is all assuming the Alpine radius is.
Okay, let's not
that's basically,
stars.
That's basically where this velocity law starts to come bite you, right? Because now if you allow there to be a velocity law as you get close to the surface, the amount of energy density in the moment, this m dot v gets small, and then this goes up, and it prevents you from going inside the star. Anyway.
I should know this, but so this thing that you came up with, then, if you put in a dipole, so whatever that is.
Or a higher particle.
And then you recover schematics law. Yeah.
This should be a plus here. I just did, this is one of the problems with doing things.
No, let me know all the different.
The bigger this confinement parameter, the bigger the Alpine radius.
Things are all simple.
Okay. So now let's let Jen give her presentation, and whatever time is left, we can talk about massive stars. And if we don't finish, we'll do it this afternoon.
This is going to serve as a reminder why we don't do magnetic fields.
I was going to say, so normally we joke about magnetic fields maybe being important, but here we can actually see that they definitely are.
And the thing is about massive stars, you can actually observe the damn things. You don't have to speculate. You have actually data on the magnetic field strength.
We speculate a lot. A lot of speculation coming.
So here we go. Why don't you read that?
Well, because massive stars generally don't have magnetic fields. I mean, there's some subset that does, but well, in the subset you can measure it, but in the non-subset you can't, right? There isn't one effectively. You have an upper limit. So saying that we can measure them in massive stars, I think.
In the 10% that are magnetic,
yeah, okay,
right. Therefore you can use
in
that
10%,
as a calibrator of your theories about how magnetic fields affect rotation, etc. We'll talk about that afterwards.